And welcome back this Friday night into the Saturday morning on Coast to Coast AM. James Fox was born in England at the age of three. He assisted his father as he traveled to locations for news stories. In 1993, James was introduced to the world of ufology by a close friend. Now, let me tell you, he was very skeptical until he started to investigate these on his own. In 1998, he completed his very first documentary for the Discovery Channel, which included such notables as Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell and the late Colonel Philip J. Corso, who was in charge of the Foreign Technology Desk at the Pentagon during the Eisenhower administration. Jim will be with us for a couple hours. He's bringing a couple of guests throughout the next few hours who will talk about the incredible case, of course, of UFOs. Here he is, James Fox. Hey, James, how are you?
I'm doing well. I thank you so much for the introduction. My gosh. I didn't realize that I've actually done a few things.
Not bad. You either have a good PR person or we wrote this up pretty darn good.
Well, I want to mention, I'm actually in Phoenix. I just flew into Phoenix. I'm actually at the Open Minds magazine to attend a gathering at the Vision Quest bookstore tomorrow. And there's details of it, of the event on the Phoenix UFO Examiner. So I wanted to kind of put that out there. So if there's anybody in the area, Phoenix area, that wants to attend, come on over.
I've got to ask you, how do you get on Larry King's show so often?
That's a good question. For some crazy reason, I think they like me. they have mentioned a couple of times that they find they're fascinated by the subject of UFOs, and they find me somewhat credible because I'm reluctant to discuss things that I can't back up, and I bring military witnesses on board with me to cooperate any stories that I put forward in my films. And I think they like that. And I think that it gives them good ratings. And so CNN's happy and they're fascinated with the subject. You know, Larry King is fascinated with the subject. He's questioned a lot of the witnesses I brought on behind the scenes during commercial breaks. And I've had some screenings with a few of the CNN executives, private screenings of I Know What I Saw.
Mm-hmm.
And it rates well. UFOs rate well.
Yeah, they do. Now, how many documentaries, Jim, do you have under your belt?
UFO documentaries, I'm going to say 3.5 because I did a second version of Out of the Blue, which was completed, but then it ended up rolling into I Know What I Saw. And it's funny, some people here at Open Minds were questioning me about an hour ago, well, are you going to do another UFO documentary? And I said, well, the last time I said I'd never do one, I did another one. And I said it again, and I did another one. So who knows?
And the subject matter generally is what? Subject matter.
My feeling is this. I think that the subject matter of UFOs is so sensational on its own. The only thing lacking is credibility. So my philosophy is if you can bring credibility to the subject matter, you've got yourself a winner. And I've had some criticism in the past from people in the UFO field saying, oh, well, James isn't really introducing anything new here. It's the same some of the cases. But my response to that is, hey, let's create a body of evidence that can be presented or can transcend the UFO community and be presented to mainstream in a digestible sort of fashion. And so I think with I Know What I Saw and Out of the Blue, we were, the proof is, we've been on Larry King a number of times and they've sort of stand behind that. So that's been my goal the whole time.
You have worked a lot with the former Arizona Governor Fife Symington, who, as you know and everybody else, James, when that Phoenix Lights situation occurred in 1997, he made fun of it. He had an alien at the news conference, a guy dressed up in a costume, and then he recanted. Then later, years later, he said, you know what? I made a mistake. He went on Larry King's show with you. I was on that program, and he admitted. There's something else going on. Yeah.
He went on a couple times with us. And there's a really interesting point I'd like to make right now, actually, since you brought the governor up. And one is there are a lot of people behind the scenes that are very influential, very in a position of power and access. Governor Symington is one of those people. He is so courageous to come forward publicly like he's done because there are so many people behind the scenes that have helped me, but when it comes down to them putting their name on it officially or publicly, they bow out almost every time. And I can't tell you, I'm going to say this tonight on the radio, Steven Spielberg watched my movie, and he wrote an amazing letter about it. And I have the letter encased in like a vacuum-sealed frame at my house, but I can't go public with it. You know, and I'm talking to his press guy, and I'm saying, well, why not? You know, all of the themes behind his movies are UFO related. And, you know, Dr. Jalen Hynek, the very foundation of his work in Project Blue Book Files, is the basis of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He even has a cameo appearance. And yet he enjoyed my movie, but he won't endorse it in any way. I mean, you know, the difference that would make would be monumental. But
why won't he? What's he holding back for?
It's a really good question.
If you make a commitment like that, you're in it, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I think that he knows as well as anyone else. I mean, and I'm not just tooting my own horn, but I know what I saw is very difficult for anyone to walk, no matter how skeptical you are, to walk away from it thinking that there's nothing to it. And I think he realized that. I don't know. I'm just speculating here, and he's just not prepared. He said not at this point. I mean, he just won't do it. But I have a letter from him. I mean, of course, my father said to me, he said, well, you could publish the letter because technically it's probably, I wouldn't do that. You know what I mean? But I have a letter with all this. I'm not making this stuff up. You know,
it's signed, right?
Exactly. And I know how he feels about the subject. He feels, you know, parallels my sentiments. Let's put it that way.
James, of everything you've done in your field here of ufology, is there a case that you've researched that still baffles you, that still frustrates you?
Well, you know, one of the things that we're working on now is assembling. We have the 30-year anniversary of the Bentwaters case. That case to me is so significant, and it's recent enough where the witnesses aren't really old. And, you know, we have the 30-year anniversary coming up, but the fact that the thing was sitting on the ground, it was touched and photographed, and there were symbols on the side of the craft, which we had analyzed, that to me is so significant. I remember editing with my editor, Boris Zuboff, in San Francisco, and his wife would always be kind of like lingering in the background for years. We did Out of the Blue together. We did some stuff on I Knew What I Saw. And she never paid any attention to UFOs. She wasn't interested. But when she heard Jim Peniston and John Burroughs and Kabansag talk about touching this spacecraft, she literally stopped everything she's doing and she said, he flippin' touched it? You know, that's really significant, you know, and the fact they got the radiation readings, they got imprints in the ground, they got the cast, plaster cast taken, then you've got the subsequent later nights with the colonel. And by the way, I almost had a statement from General Gordon Williams that I was going to present and even get him on the radio with us tonight, but he had some health complications and is in the hospital. So,
well, we've got a couple of people joining us over the next couple hours that you brought forward. James Peniston coming up right after the break, who will tell us some incredible things. Bentwaters, by the way, the Rendlesham case we're talking about was in England.
And yeah, December 1980.
Yeah, Linda Moultonhouse done some research on this too, James, as you know. It is an incredible case. What keeps driving you, though? Why do you keep into this? Why don't you just stop?
I know. Well, a couple of reasons. One is, and I think that the audience out there listening tonight can agree with me on this, if you can just imagine for a moment, hypothetically, whether you believe in UFOs or not, if they were real, I think everyone could agree that it would be one of the most significant discoveries of our time. I think it would have a very unifying effect on all of us. A very humbling effect on all of us.
I would put it up there with Noah's Ark, the Ark of the Covenant, and UFOs. And even though both of those biblical events, to me, are just historical, the thought of UFOs and ET visitations would be, I think, one of the biggest stories of all time.
Absolutely. And so having said that, having gone around the world and meeting with all these military guys and civilian witnesses, I'm convinced that these things are real. I don't know who's piloting them. Either way, either we're in possession of technology that's so far beyond anything we have, we wouldn't have to be tapping in oil. I was listening to the report earlier about that oil spill. I mean, it's catastrophic. So either we're in possession of this technology, could we replace all these fossil fuels, or we're being visited. And in either case, that's an extraordinary story. And I can't walk away from it, George.
Well, and what amazes me too, James, you know, I came back this weekend from the X conference in Washington, D.C. There are so many diehard researchers who are devoting their careers to trying to get the answer here. I mean, I've never seen people so, I don't want to use the word obsessed, but I have never seen so many people so concerned about getting the answer to this.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up with the other people research. And one of the things that really frustrates me, and I really think it's time for get some serious traction on this whole issue, is the fact that there's all this bickering going on among UFO researchers, and competitiveness and bickering, and I would like nothing more if we can all combine forces and focus on a common goal. You know, let's stop the bickering. Let's work together, because I have to quote Pink Floyd on this. You know, together we stand, divided we fall. I think there's enough resources out there, there are enough people out there that we can actually make policy, a shift in policy with this. But it's going to take us all kind of putting our differences aside and focusing on a common goal and working together. And I really hope anyone out there is listening to this. I've started a website. It's, I have a fan page now on Facebook.
Oh, are you there now, huh? Welcome to the 29th century. Right?
Exactly. Well, I put this Facebook page, and I thought, no one's going to even notice this thing. I don't even know why I'm doing this. You know, and everyone kept saying, yeah, you got to do this. And so I put the photo galleries together, and I put some links on the video, you know. And 3 days later, I look over, and I got 1,500 people signed up, and I thought, wow, this is a really good way to network. We can really work together on this. I can communicate with people. I don't need a radio station or TV station. You know, we can do the Twitters and we can do the Facebook. And so it's an amazing tool in that respect. And I'm asking anyone to go on to Facebook and sign on, and I will keep you, everyone in the loop, and really keep pushing forward on this.
We set up a Twitter feed for coasttocoastam.com some time ago, and it is amazing to get information out to people.
It's phenomenal.
You cannot beat the technology for speed.
And then you're suddenly connected with all the people they're connected, and then keeps going. It's truly phenomenal, and it's hard for me to kind of grasp the whole shift in technique and getting this stuff out there. But it's extremely effective, and I think that it's going to be a boon for this whole movement. Oh, and by the way, I just wanted to, if you wouldn't mention, you'd mentioned out of the blue. It's actually I Know What I Saw, and I have a little link on my website. For anyone who, any cases out there, any photographs out there, or anyone who wants to be a part of this movement to sign up, put their name on our website, I'll communicate directly with them, or go to the Facebook page.
You're still chasing these answers, James, aren't you? You're looking for them.
George, I can't walk away from it. As much as I'd like to, I just can't. I have other interests. I'm doing conservation films. I'm doing stuff on Antarctica. But my passion is I can't walk away from it. I also feel like I have people that have supported me and continue to support me, and that I don't want to let them down. I'd like to see congressional hearings in my lifetime. I'd like to see it soon. I'd like to organize screenings in Washington, D.C., and have members of Congress and the media there, and let them interact with witnesses, let them learn about the subject matter, and do away with this whole tongue-in-cheek thing that's happening with the media. I think it's time for some serious reporting on this.
I think so, too. Now, we're going to bring James Peniston in just a few moments, and he will be able to talk with us about his situation and his case. How did you find him, Jim?
You know, it's so funny. It took me so long to get James Peniston to even listen to me. I had to get through to so many different people. I finally got to him, got with him, and we've been great friends. We keep in touch with each other all the time. And I think I spent 5, 6, 7, 8 years trying to reach him, and I couldn't even get to him.
Well, we got him now, and he's next with you on Coast to Coast AM. And you're listening to Coast Worldwide. I'm George Norrie. The Rendlesham Forest Incident is the name given to a series of reported sightings of unexplained lights and the landing of a craft of unknown origin in Rendlesham Forest in England in late December of 1980. Some ufologists believe it is perhaps the most famous UFO event to have happened in Britain, ranking amongst the best-known UFO events worldwide. It has been compared to the Roswell UFO incident in the United States. It's sometimes referred to as Britain's Roswell. Now, the Ministry of Defense there has denied that the event posed any threat to national security, whatever that means, and stated that it was therefore never investigated as a security matter. I like how they hedge that. Well, we've got for you for the rest of this hour, along with James Fox, James Peniston. He entered the Air Force in 1973 and was assigned to the Strategic Air Command Elite Guard in Omaha, Nebraska. In 1980, He was placed in charge of the security police plans and programs at RAF Bentwaters in England. Here's James Peniston. James, how are you, sir?
I'm doing just good there, George. How are you?
Great. Thank you for serving, by the way.
Well.
Now, tell me a little bit about your mission. Yeah, so you were out that way. Tell me about the command that you took following the incident. What actions?
Well, once I was notified and was dispatched to go off base for a possible aircraft downing, I assembled the team and went approximately about 300 yards off base where we had our encounter with a craft of unknown origin.
What did you see, James?
Well, as we approached the tree line, it was a very bright light emanating from the woods. But as we got a little bit closer, the light started to dissipate, and we could see a silhouette of a craft, the shape of the craft forming. And as we get up with it, maybe within 10, 15 feet of it, the bright light had dissipated altogether, and there was just lighting of blue and red running through the fabric of the craft.
Could you see shape at this point?
Oh, it was defined shape. It was triangular in shape. It measured approximately 6.5 feet high by 9 feet on the ground. It was in most of the area of the craft itself was probably about 60 or 70% opaque, black-like fabric of the craft was black-like, more like a glass finish.
I'm not going to ask you about origin yet, James, but you have no doubt that this was a physical structure, right?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. The craft was situated on the forest floor, and it was solid and it was unmovable.
It left imprints in the ground, which they have the plaster casts of.
That's right, James. You know, the ground temperature at that time, because the next morning was measured or was taken, and it was like 31 degrees, and the depressions were anywhere from about 1.5 to 2 inches in the ground. So it was quite heavy, but light for aircraft standards. It was probably, well, later on a team had estimated what the weight was based on the ground temperature, and they estimated about 7 tons. And, you know, that's very light for an aircraft, even a fighter aircraft, you know, 25, 30 tons.
How long did you stay out there, James, witnessing the craft?
I was doing a 360 around the craft, you know, doing my investigation, trying to determine if the craft is hostile.
How close did you get?
I was right at the craft. I mean, I was...
oh, my God.
I was right next to it. And, you know, I was actually physically touching it. You know.
Yeah, touching it, yeah.
You know, yes, Jim, go ahead.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I just want to emphasize that Jim Peniston wasn't alone. He was actually with John Burroughs and Ed Kabansag. Ed Kabansag wasn't at the actual craft, but he walked out towards the craft with them and then stayed back as a relay for the radio transmission.
He was okay. The radio relay. Yeah, the actual two people around the craft is myself and Airman Burroughs.
Yeah.
But, you know, we also had our whole security contingent, you know, less than 300 yards away, which is another 16 security policemen there.
Yeah, Burroughs was in D.C. with us this weekend Linda Moulton Howe. They gave great testimony, as you do, James. So when you touched the craft, what did it feel like? Was it hot? Was it cold?
The craft was somewhat warm. But you got to remember the temperature outside was you know, 32, 33 degrees, and it felt warm to the touch. The air around the craft was giving an electrical charge off. If we could feel that on our clothes, our skin, our hair. Of course, some of that, you know, might have been a little adrenaline going on there, but it was consistent. And even after, you know, I settled down. I determined there was no threat that I could see from this craft. It was sitting there inert. conducted, you know, a further investigation of it, but walking around it, taking my notes. We had taken pictures going up to it. And then it was on the ground approximately, 45 minutes. And then it started to generate light throughout the fabric of the craft, and it started to get brighter. And John and I, Aaron Burroughs, we took a defensive position, probably about 25 feet from the craft, and watched it rise up to tree level, hover momentarily, and then take off in a blink of an eye.
Without any sound, wake, air disturbance.
There was no sound. There was no air displacement. Let me describe something a little bit better with the craft describing it.
All right, James.
Some of the things I was looking for on the craft, obviously, were crew compartments, intakes, exhausts, things of that nature, and it was void of all those. It was a solid surface on it, and it was for the 9 feet long by 6.5 feet high. It was a very small craft, and I was looking for the crew compartments. I said, well, you know, this has to be a one-seater or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was just no windows at all. And that's the other odd thing on takeoff, besides not having the air displacement that you get from engines and noise, I could not determine what the power source was for that.
So you couldn't see any engines or a hole in the middle of it or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely not. It was completely foreign. I've never seen anything like that.
What's now, amazing? Oh, sorry.
Any insignias on it at all, James, or any markings that?
Right on the one of the things I recorded on the far side of the craft, I was looking at it. There were symbols, pictorial type symbols, that were etched into the fabric of the craft, and they measured probably a few inches high, and they stretched out for about 2 feet. And these were completely foreign, too. I've never seen anything like them. One of the interesting things about those symbols in the film that James did, I Know What I Saw, is he had taken those to a professor in England, and they had examined them and come up with possibilities of what they were. And their answer was it was some type of mathematical cipher of some kind.
It was mathematics. I remember the mathematician saying to me when I gave him these symbols that a light bulb went on in his head. It was almost like he kind of thought he might have decoded it. And one of the things they've always said in the past, Jim, is that the only universal language, of course, I'm not a mathematician myself, but I've been told the only universal language is mathematics. So that's the one way that we could communicate with an extraterrestrial race. And when he looked at these symbols, some of them obviously didn't make any sense, but some of them did. And he thinks, what's that sequence? But it's found everywhere in nature. And
Pi?
Fibonacci. Fibonacci. The Fibonacci sequence. He saw that in one of the symbols.
Let me ask you this, James. If there was one occupant in there, let's say, well, let me rephrase it. If there was an occupant in there the size of a human being, how many do you think could fit in there? Just the one?
One small human being, yes.
All right. Yes.
Here's the other thing that could not happen. It couldn't have been manned. Not with a human being, but now I know this because when the craft accelerated from 0 miles per hour, and whatever the speed would be, in a blink of an eye, be out of sight, which I would imagine be thousands of miles per hour. Nobody would be able to withstand the G-force involved with an acceleration like that.
Well, let me ask you, was it an acceleration, or did it disappear as if it went into another dimension or through a portal?
Well, from my point of observation, it was just blink and it was gone.
Gone.
But I'm going to other eyewitnesses that are around Bentwaters and in the weapon storage areas and stuff like that. They actually seen it go ahead and head north, as a streak.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm just going by what the other witnesses have said to me on that.
Okay. But what if there were ET occupants in this craft, but they weren't the size of human beings? They were 6 or 7 inches tall, let's say. Let's just say that. How many could be in there then? Many?
Well, if they were 3 or 4 feet tall, George, they'd probably be able to handle 3, maybe 4.
Look how many people they got in the Gemini mission. Those capsules were tiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They got them at the Smithsonian. Look in there. It's like a tin can.
They squeezed the two in there, didn't they, side by side?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, it would have been very tight quarters, I'm sure. But I'm thinking, a 6 foot person, it would have been very, very, very tight for one person there.
Did we have drones in 1980, James Fox?
Gosh, James Pattison would be more.
No, we didn't have any drones.
No drones then. Okay.
No.
Did you think at any point, James, that this was man-made? The United States has it, or Britain has it? But it's man-made. Did you think that at all while you were looking at it?
That was the last thing that came to mind. The last thing. It was not man-made. It wasn't in the James book of known aircraft. And I'll tell you what, as a security policeman over there, we were routinely, 2 or 3 times a month in our security police training, showing silhouettes of all NATO aircraft, all U.S. aircraft, all Warsaw Pact aircraft. It wasn't a standard aircraft.
Can I mention something really quickly? Because this is the propulsion is what gets me, James. There was an article in Life magazine, I believe it was published in 1952, and it was an investigation from Life, and I know the Air Force cooperated with Life magazine on this. And one of the conclusions, which I feature, and I know what I saw, but they say no known propulsion could account for the performances of these devices. And that was the conclusion in 1952. And it applies exactly to what Jim Pattison's talking about. There is just no known propulsion behind this craft. I mean,
they're using anti-gravity, and they've got to be using it with some form of magnetics.
Yeah, I mean, with no sound and no wake, no air disturbance, no sonic boom. How can you accelerate something from a standstill to out of sight? I talked to people that witnesses that saw this massive craft a mile across flying over Phoenix in 1997, March 1997. And a whole family saw it just take off and in the blink of an eye. Exactly how James Pattison describes this craft taking off is this craft that was a mile across. They said literally had I blinked, I would have missed it. It shot off with no sound, no air disturbance.
There could have been a mothership, too. And this may have been, going back up to it.
What is this?
George, that technology, it cannot be replicated today. I mean, it's just the maneuvering and the with no sight. There was complete silence. It was silent running craft. I mean, we have nothing that's silent running. And I doubt if we'll have anything in the next 50 years that's silent running.
What happened afterwards, James? I'm very, very interested in finding out what the reaction was of your superiors after the fact.
Well, immediately that morning, of course, we were debriefed by the shift commander. He was the number 3 guy at the squadron. And both John and I were debriefed. And he took the debriefing quite well. And reminded us why he was tapping his pencil on the table that Project Blue Book ended in 1969, and we had no way of actually reporting this. Then myself and John were put on 6 days off, and during that time, at least I did, and I think John did some work on it too, we took time to do our notes and statements were made. And the reports were furnished to the command headquarters, and also major debriefings were accomplished. We had the one by the day shift commander, and then we also had detailed ones that followed because those were top secret briefings, and I did have a top secret clearance, so I was privy to mainly doing that. him, and John wasn't. He had a U.S. secret. Then I also had a one-on-one with the W base commander, wing commander, debriefing. Then we had the situation the following night with Halt, Colonel Halt.
That's right.
And after the second incident, when he went out to debunk it, the first one, Halt got tied up into a situation he didn't know what was, he couldn't explain either. And then all of a sudden, after that faltered, we started having more and more debriefings on it.
James, I've got to tell you, your description of what you saw is probably one of the best I have ever heard. James Fox, would you agree?
Absolutely, beyond a shadow of doubt. And the more people we come on board, and this is like one of the strongest cases that we have today. There's tangible evidence. There's radar report readings, high radar levels at the exact location of where this thing landed. There's the plaster cast of the imprints in the ground. There's multiple eyewitness testimony. There are the symbols on the craft. James, how many people saw this thing take off on the base?
Well, there was over 80 security policemen that were on duty, and they seen it up to 3 miles away. Our sister base was RAF Bentwaters, and it was 3 miles away, and it was observed on takeoff from that base.
Just amazing. Were there any windows in it, James, or little portals or anything?
No, it was completely a solid surface. I looked all over. I looked underneath it. I looked on the sides. I mean, I was looking for some way to – I knew there was going to be questions. I mean, I had to go ahead and do the best I could as far as ascertaining what was –
You said there were pictures. Who's got them?
They were turned into the base photo lab, and when we went down to pick them up, they were all whited out. So,
oh my God!
I don't know if they're whited out from the radiation, or if it was intentional, or what.
Well, you know, Colonel Pennis. Sorry, Jim.
Thank you very much, James. I appreciate it.
Colonel.
Yeah, he's been a friend. James, we're coming up. We're coming up to the clock.
I'll be really quick. Colonel Halt said that an unknown agency, he was deputy base commander, an unknown agency came in a day or a couple days later and sort of sanitized everything, took some of the witnesses, interrogated them, subjected them to sodium pentothal. That's what Colonel Halt said, and he had no control of it, and he doesn't know where the agency came from.
Truly amazing. Up next, another witness who listened to the radio transmissions the night of the encounter, James Peniston. Thank you so much. Incredible detail. I'll be back in a moment. Now, James Fox and I would like to introduce you to Paul Tazinski, a retired Air Force member. Paul was posted on Fox One, an entry control point for an aircraft parking area for what was the A-10 aircraft. The post was across the taxiway from the Central Security Control and approximately 200 or 300 yards from the weapons storage area on RAF Bentwaters. Paul heard all the radio transmissions the night of the encounter, and here he is. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Good, good. And James, tell us a little bit about Paul and your relationship, how you found him.
So Paul and I spoke a night or two ago about the incident. I was amazed, Paul, that you, because you hadn't spoken to Jim Peniston since 1984.
And you
described what happened to me when we had our first conversation. And I just thought, my God, this cooperates exactly what I've heard from Cabansack, from Burroughs, from Peniston. It was amazing. And then, of course, I turned you on to that link that you could see that one segment of I Know What I Saw. That you could, it was so very impressive. And I'm dying to hear more.
Yeah. Tell us now, Paul, did you see anything, first of all, before we get to the radio transmissions? Did you see this object?
Oh, no, not from where I was at.
Okay. All right. Tell us about the radio transmissions. When they first started coming in, what did you hear? What was the chatter?
The night started off, it was it was a slow night because it was around the holidays, Christmas time, and we were doing stuff on the radio we shouldn't have been doing, goofing off and stuff, and then the controller come across and broke in and dispatched Jimmy Peniston and to
and Burroughs, I guess.
And Kabansack was with him to rendezvous with Burroughs to investigate a possible downed aircraft out the east gate of Woodbridge. And basically UFO type of deal. And Jim Pennington came back and was like, "Is this for real or is this a joke?" And then the controller got real serious. He said, "No, break. This is the real deal. No unnecessary radio transmissions this time." And then, they went and dispatched, Pennington with Kabansack and Burroughs to the east gate to go off base and investigate.
How long did it take Pennington to get there, Paul, in terms of before the next radio transmission?
It was a couple minutes. Nothing,
That's all. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. As he was approaching, we just talked with him, but I want to get your views and your thoughts on this. What did you hear coming from the Pennington group?
Well, when they got dispatched off base, you could hear when they were doing radio transmissions, you could hear, in the background, you could hear, them talking about the animals acting all crazy and, like they were upset, disturbed, and, it was really weird, and they were seeing lights. An object, and they would get close to it and move, and, to the point where they were up on it. The radio transmissions themselves started getting interrupted, and one of our flight sergeants was out there, flight chief, got to the point where he was having to relay Pennington and command sack's transmissions to the controller to, let him know pretty much what was going on.
Now, this happened in 1980, so they were well aware of UFOs. Did they use those words at all when they came up to the craft, Pennington and Burroughs?
Well, they were initially sent. It was for unidentified flying object.
Okay, so when Pennington came on, and when I talk in terms of Pennington, it's he and his group. When they came on to the scene and they could physically see this thing, what did they say? It looks like a plane, or this looks like it's out of this world. What did they say, Paul?
Oh, they didn't know what it was. I mean, it was nothing. It wasn't an aircraft for sure. Something. Pretty much something they'd never seen before.
Could you sense an air of excitement or any feelings of being scared from their voices?
I don't want to say scared. Puzzlement, maybe. I mean, and like I said, everything was quiet. Nobody else was, trying to cut in on any of the transmissions. I sat. I mean, I sat there, and it was like, kind of amazed what I was listening to.
Oh, sure. As they were walking around the craft, were they radioing back to you guys what they were seeing?
Yeah, they were. Well, at that point, they were having problems with the radios, and they were pretty much transmitting through the flight sergeant. He was acting like a go-between, a repeater. What they were seeing, lights. The animals were getting, crazy. It was acting really weird. And again, like I said, it kept moving away from them, and it got to the point where they started coming back, and it was in front of them again. And then, at that point, I think is when Jim approached it and got close enough to touch it.
When it finally took off, Paul, did they describe over the radio?
It was just
this
gone.
Thing was
like,
leaving.
Snap of a finger and it was gone.
And they seemed like they were amazed.
Oh yeah, it was. The thing was moving like nothing we'd ever seen.
After the fact, what did you folks talk about?
As far as talking to them guys.
Yeah, or chatter amongst each other.
Well, it was like they were sort of out of pocket for a couple of days because, they were pulled in for, debrief, investigation, whatever you want to call it. And, they were pretty much put into the point where, it was a shut up. They couldn't talk about it. They were clammed up and, really couldn't talk about anything.
Were there rumors circulating on the base? Was there, like, an underlying, like, something going on behind the scenes? What did it feel like, Paul?
Well, it felt kind of weird because when this stuff got out, and I didn't mention this to you the other night when we talked, but it was like our flight itself was like, you know, we were like a bunch of whack jobs. That,
really?
You know, we were like the redheaded stepchildren, so it happened again, you know, a night or two later, then it was like, okay, now we were off the hook, and, you know, somebody else has seen this thing.
Then this was getting pretty darn serious, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Did you come up with your own theories, Paula, what the heck this thing could have been?
Listening to them guys, it's something we don't have. I mean, like I said, you know, Jim's been around a while. I went to tech school with Cab. Cab was, you know, Cabansack was a pretty good guy.
Yeah.
And like I said, they'd seen something that we didn't know what it was.
Are you convinced they saw something that it wasn't a joke or a hoax?
Absolutely. I believe that for a fact.
James Fox, did any of the members out there, or Paul, maybe you can help us too, did they ever get radiation burns or anything like that?
Well, you know, it's really funny you should mention that, George, because when I introduced Jim Pennison, I believe, to Nick Pope, or when they met up in Washington, D.C. in 2007, I guess some documents had released from the MOD that Nick Pope had, basically saying that and this is something he never knew about, Jim Pennison never knew about, he was exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. So anyone who went near this thing, and of course the radiation readings the following day at the landing site were really high, but they were exposed that night to high levels of radiation.
And how's his health now? Is he okay?
Yeah, he's okay. John is complaining about some things. And, I'm sorry, we should have asked Jim when he was on. I'm not entirely sure. I know there's been some, he feels ramifications, but, I don't know. Paul, have you heard anything about this?
Well, the following day, I didn't go out. It was our day off, and I didn't go out. But there were some guys that had gone out to the crate where the site was of where the object was, and they had seen the burn marks in the ground where something had actually landed. There was trees that were broken. Supposedly somebody was out there with a Geiger counter or something. They were picking up levels of radiation.
Did anybody talk about the possibility this could have been a Soviet craft, Paul?
There was all kinds of rumors floating around. I mean, the Brits even thought it, you know, there was an article in the paper by the Brits that, you know, they thought we were covering up one of our aircraft that had crashed with a nuclear weapon on it, and we didn't want to come clean that we had, you know, there was nuclear weapons.
Wow. But this thing took off. A crashed plane couldn't do that.
No.
Was there any helicopter activity over the scene at all?
No. The only helicopters in the area would have been, we had a pararescue unit and stuff, but they weren't activated. They weren't doing anything that night.
Here we are now, 30 years later, Paul. What do you think?
It's still unexplained. I mean, I've seen a lot of stuff on it on, you know, different TV shows and some articles I've read and stuff, and it's still, you know, nobody's disproven it.
I don't know if you were a believer in extraterrestrial life in 1980, but are you now?
It was definitely something that's still unexplained.
Yeah, I mean, we can't say what it was, but we can't say what it wasn't, right? I mean,
exactly.
Or you can say what it was, I'm so sorry, but we can't confirm exactly what it was. And that's the fascinating thing about this. I mean, you do the process of elimination, what's left, you know? It doesn't appear to be, I mean, from the witnesses I've talked to, Paul, you probably agree with me, it doesn't appear to have been of terrestrial origin, but who knows, right?
But again, like I said, you've got people that are trained and know what's going on, and when they can't, you know, explain what's going on, it makes you wonder.
It really does. Well, Paul, I want to thank you for your insight into this. This is a remarkable part of the story.
No problem.
Paul, thank you so much for coming forward tonight. Really, really appreciate it. And if there's anybody else out there that wants to join us to come forward about this incident, this is the 30-year anniversary of this incident. Contact us on our Facebook page for I Know What I Saw.
James, as you look at this thing now, 30 years of this case, the Britain Roswell, basically, what are you concluding? I mean, you've investigated a lot. You've looked at a lot of cases. What do you think happened here?
I think this is one of the cases that we could actually take and present to members of Congress with enough witnesses. There are enough live witnesses left, coherent. These men were young at the time.
They're in their late 40s.
Solid,
50s.
Truthful. They're not gaining anything by this.
You know, the fact that Paul came forward, he's feeling comfortable enough to come forward. I got contacted by another guy who's possibly wanting to come forward. There's talk of a guy that was in the tower that saw the whole thing from the tower of it taking off.
Burroughs has come forward.
It's the 30-year anniversary. I think what we should do is we should have a big event in Washington, D.C. We should invite all the members, all the witnesses out to it. We should possibly have a little screening, invite members of Congress, invite the media, and really expose the truth about this. It's such a solid case. And I hear people in the UFO community say, oh, well, we've been there, done that. No, this has not been explained. You heard what Paul just said. This is still unexplained. Let's get to the bottom of it. Let's demand answers from the United States Air Force. Let's demand Congress to put these guys on as witnesses on stand and testify. Let's get answers.
We had some audio a long time ago of Colonel Hult making his way through the scene there. And
oh my gosh, it's amazing!
It is great stuff.
I reunited Colonel Hult Monroe Nevels for the first time. I think it was 27 years. They hadn't seen each other. And they just, like, finished each other's sentences for each other. Do you know what I mean? They hadn't talked about this thing since it had happened, pretty much, time.
Do you think that Peniston and company got onto the scene too soon because this thing, you know, stayed there, landed for a little bit, and then left? Do you think they were taken by surprise, the craft, the occupants, maybe, if they were inside?
Well, I do know this. This is what Colonel Hult told me. He said when he heard about it, he kind of chuckled to himself. He was the deputy base commander. He kind of chuckled to himself. And when the lights reappeared, I believe it was a night later, he went out with a crew of people, I think five. Nevels was one, number of guys, with, you know, the distinct idea that there was a prosaic explanation behind this, and he was just, you know, come on, I'm going to go resolve this once and for all. And he found himself in a situation that he had no idea how to deal with, and all the other men. They said this object was shooting beams of light down into the weapon storage area, and they were doing these. He said, Colonel Hult told me, he said they were looking for something. I said, well, how do you know that? He said, because they were doing a grid search in the sky, these objects, and they'd fly soundless, just like the way Jim described them flying. They would do 90-degree angle right turns. They had the ability to stop and disappear in the blink of an eye, and then they shot beams of light down into the weapon storage area, and then they shot beams of light down right at the feet. And this is all on tape, you know, audio tape, right at the feet of Colonel Hult and the guys that were with him. It's just amazing to hear this story. What were they doing there? What were they looking for? You know, weapons? It's crazy.
Well, I was going to say, if it was ours, what would we be doing there? So that doesn't make any sense. Is, you know, landing out there in the forest somewhere? It just doesn't make any sense. And then leaving again like that?
There's been so many different... you know, in my previous film, Out of the Blue, I document a lot of cases where UFOs and nuclear weapons are spotted. And it seems to be a point of interest to someone. I mean, White Sands, New Mexico, when all this, you know, the modern-day UFO thing started. Minuteman missile cases in Malmstrom Air Force Base. I mean, and then you've got Bentwaters, which at the time nobody knew they were housing nuclear weapons. But they were shooting beams of light down into the nuclear weapons storage area. And what was a craft doing sitting on the ground? I mean, my God, it's crazy. So I think that all the elements for if any story is going to break this into the mainstream, I think that Bentwaters has all the ingredients to do that. There are enough witnesses. There's enough tangible evidence. Obviously, having a photograph of the craft would be great, but we don't have that.
Oh, we came close, didn't we?
No.
They gave them away.
I said the same thing to Jim Peniston that you said to him. First time I ever interviewed, I'll never forget, he talked about the photographs. And later on in the interview, I said, wait a minute, you took photographs? What happened to those photographs? You know, then he told me, very frustrating.
I would have put one in my back pocket at least.
You know? No. But you know what I find, George, even if a really good photograph is out with points of reference, I mean, look at 1950, Trent, the Trent, you got multiple eyewitnesses, got the crystal clear, totally in focus, points of reference, no scientific, I mean, they're even analyzing Condon report, and yet people say, oh, well, if those UFOs were real, then we'd have, we do have photographic evidence. Some of it is pretty quite impressive, actually. You know, the Trent photos, case in point, two photographs, two witnesses, points of reference, crystal clear, negatives. But people still say, well, we need a photograph. But they're, you know, anyway.
The Ministry of Defense basically says, this posed no threat to national security. That doesn't tell me anything.
Well, Nick Pope had a very interesting, I heard you mention that earlier, and that's what they said, but he obviously worked for the MOD investigating UFOs. And his response to that was, wait a minute, how can you draw that conclusion when you don't know what it was?
Unless they did know what it was, and maybe it was a friendly ET and they knew that.
Nothing of any defense interest took place.
No.
I remember hearing that from Admiral Lord Hill Norton. He was very doggedly sticking to his guns in questioning the MOD on how they could draw that conclusion.
That was a sightseeing trip by an ET. Just happened to find their way into Rendlesham Forest.
But isn't it interesting how they were shooting beams of light down in the weapon storage area?
Yes.
And if you listen to those tapes, I'm sure people can find them on YouTube, but if you listen to those, the excitement in the voices, and multiple eyewitnesses watching this whole thing go down, the excitement in the voices, they're frightened. You hear the deputy base commander, who's the colonel, saying, you know, oh, my God, this is unreal. You know, it's just, it's not.
How can folks find your Facebook again?
The Facebook is just I Know What I Saw. And then the website, if you want to view the trailer or if you want to get an autographed copy of the DVD, it's just been released as of about a week ago, is iknowwhatisawthemovie.com.
Super. Stay with us, James. We've got 30 minutes to go, and I'd like to take phone calls with you when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM before we have open lines next hour. James Fox, our special guest, he put together this incredible documentary on the Rendlesham Forest incident, and we'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. James, did you investigate the Colonel Hult memo at all?
I did. I actually featured that in Out of the Blue when that came out in, I think, 2003. It's so funny because Colonel Hult writes this memo, right? And at the bottom of it, he says this event was witnessed by many. And then he says, including the undersigned. So he very discreetly includes himself as a witness in this United States Air Force memo. And then, of course, he signs it, Colonel Charles J. Hult.
Yeah. There it is.
It was really funny. I had a good laugh, and I really read it carefully about the way he describes it. You could find it on – people can just Google it, Colonel Hult memo. It's what blew this thing out in the open in the first place. But it's funny the way he mentions it. He includes himself as one of the witnesses very discreetly.
Wasn't there a police log involved in this case somehow,
yeah.
You know?
Well, Peniston had his official logbook, which he never turned in. He kept it. And you see his handwriting, you know, we're at, you know, zero whatever hours and we're approaching the object. And as they get closer to the object, his handwriting becomes progressively worse. When he gets up on the object, his handwriting looks like chicken scratch.
He's shaking like a leaf.
I promise you, I've seen this with my own eyes, the original logbook. And then he's drawing the symbols down on the craft. He's like, you know, put him in his logbook. And he has his logbook and he said, I never gave it. I never turned it in. I kept it. You know, it has all these descriptions. And then when it says, when the object took off, he writes so many details about the object in his logbook, you know, the color, what it felt like, the warmth of the touch, the symbols. And then it says, the object just took off, and he gives the exact time, and then he puts speed, and then he writes impossible in huge letters with about 15 exclamation points.
Amazing.
Absolutely amazing.
Amazing. Let's go to the phones. First-time caller, Philip in Huntington, West Virginia. Welcome to Coast, Philip. Go ahead. You're on with James Fox.
Hi. Thanks for having me. This is my very first time calling.
Well, thank you for joining.
I just wanted to point out, you know, how lucky we are to have heard about this case, thanks to journalists like your guest and everyone else involved.
Absolutely.
Considering that it was military personnel involved, especially, and considering how many, you know, civilians have reported things like this, is it possible there's other good cases like this one that we haven't heard about from the military?
My gosh. Absolutely. You know, think of all the things that we don't know about, you know, some of the cases that happened much earlier, perhaps that, you know, the witnesses are dying off. I mean, so absolutely. I mean, I constantly think about how many cases we don't know about, and I get emails from very concerned military personnel. One guy was a former sheriff all the time, actually, talking about very unambiguous UFO encounters during their official duties quite often, but I don't have the resources and the time to research them all. And, you know, so, yeah, your answer to your question is, yeah, there are lots of.
I mean, it only takes one public information officer not willing to talk to the press or one other person in the chain of information to just give up and not put it out there.
Absolutely. And, you know, as with this case and with many others, you'll get a concerted effort by somebody, don't ask me who, but somebody to diffuse or muddy the whole story with a bunch of bunk stuff. Do you know what I mean? Aliens interacting with the deputy Bates. They just, you know, just to kind of dumb down the whole thing or make it so bad that nobody wants to associate themselves with it. It's a very effective campaign. And actually that began, I think, in that whole policy shift happened in 52.
It's understandable. As a hardened skeptic myself, you know, this is one of the few cases that really convinces me there's a real phenomenon. And I think that's why they're so scared of it.
Right. I mean, I think this is one of the cases. I was talking to George about this earlier, is that this is one of the cases I think we can take to Congress. We've got enough witnesses. We've got enough evidence and really shake things up. And we've got the 30-year anniversary happening this year. So now's the time to strike to do this.
You know, even, and I expect them to say, well, we don't know what it is, but at least an admission, you know, James?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, just to be able to say, we don't know what it was. Yes, we were visited. But Ed Kabansag told me that they forced him to sign a document that said what they saw was just the lighthouse beacon. He's like, I know perfectly well that wasn't. I saw that lighthouse beacon every night. It was sitting on the ground. I mean, he's like, this is ridiculous. He had to sign that. That's what he told me. Actually, I have it, and out of the blue, you can see it. You can Google it or something. But, yeah, lighthouse beacon.
Let's go to Casey in Sacramento, California. Hi, Casey. Go ahead.
Well, I was a airman based at RAF Mildenhall, which wasn't too far from Bentwaters. And an additional lead you might want to follow up is the F-111s that used to fly out of Lakenheath, England, RAF Lakenheath, had, like, the very best radar for aircraft at the time. So,
hello?
Yeah.
Wait. He said so.
You still with us, Casey? Well, he's gone. He hung up. That's weird.
That was really, he was just getting to the heart of it.
He was ready to tell us some kind of a blockbuster. Oh, well.
I was on the edge of my seat, seriously. can I say something really quickly?
No.
There's an event tomorrow. I happen
of course
to be in
you can.
Okay, sorry. If anyone out there can Google the Phoenix UFO Examiner by Larry Lowe, there's an event being put on by Phoenix MUFON at the Vision Quest bookstore in Scottsdale. So if anyone's in the Scottsdale, Phoenix, Tucson area, to come on by. It's going to be tomorrow. I'm going to be there for that. We're going to be showing some clips from the movie, and hopefully, you know, anyone listening could make it.
And you don't stop. Let's go to Feli in Honolulu, Hawaii. Hey, Feli, go ahead. Aloha.
Hi, George. Hi, James. Great show. Just had a short story. Well, a friend of mine had an incident in Japan where they seemed to be followed by a light up in the sky that appeared to be a UFO. And right after that, once she got home, she was under an obsessed spell. It appeared that she was just making drawings. She's a very good painter and drawer. She started drawing all these scenes of like underground areas and people interacting with ships and all these different things and it kind of blew her mind. And she had all these different paintings for a while until later on in her life where she became real religious and decided that this was work of the devil or something like that and got rid of them, you know. And now she can't remember any of that stuff. Or she remembers some of it, but not all of it, you know.
Well, go ahead, James.
I'm so sorry. I was saying I get a lot of very supportive email from people, but then I also get that angle from people that are very, very, I don't even want to say religious, I guess, but I think it conflicts so much with their religious beliefs that they demonize it, and I've been accused of, like, coercion with the devil, and that this is, you know, the devil reincarnate coming back. And I mean, just what do I say to that? You know, I mean, this is a big universe, and hey, maybe God created everything in it, you know?
Well, there's a camp out there that believes that UFOs and ETs are demonic. I mean, they, you know, that's one of the theories I was talking about at the X conference. I laid out a scenario where I concluded that they're coming from planetary systems, even though I weighed dimensional other multiverses as a strong possibility as well. But demons popped up as a very high probability too.
Can I read you a first sentence of an email I got just recently?
Sure.
Hello, James. You are really one screwed up guy. Seeing all those things that nobody else sees mean you are really, really need to see a psychiatrist. You're making yourself look like a fool. So I get these like hate mails sometimes too, you know. But I was like, wait a minute, I'm not even suggesting that I saw anything. I'm just allowing a platform for very credible witness who claim to have seen something during their official duties. So things, I don't know. People believe what they want to believe, I guess.
It happens. Burlington, Iowa, it's Steve's turn, east of the Rockies. Hey, good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing this morning?
Okay.
Fine, thank you.
Okay, my question is, you were saying, I want to know, did that spacecraft go, oh, I'm going to say craft, did it go over the military installation first and beam the light down in there and then take off and land?
Well, from what I understand, on the first night, it was just reported that there was a downed craft in the woods.
Right.
About the base. Now, the second night, when Colonel Holt took a team of men out with him to investigate and figured there was a conventional explanation, he was convinced of it, that is when it was above the base, the very sensitive weapon storage area. And that's the way Colonel Holt refers to it, because he can't admit, even now, retired, that there were nuclear weapons. So he says, we had very sensitive weapon storage area. And that's
well, I was kind of wondering because now if it went over that, let's say its propulsion system was going over that system or over, you know, over our nuclears and then taken off, and maybe it had to land because it overloaded itself with radiation. Maybe that's what the red crackling was when the gentleman went up to the craft to look at the craft. He said didn't he say it was there for 45 minutes too?
Yeah, about 45 minutes. That was the first night, and then the second night is when it was observed. Multiple craft observed shooting beams of light down into the weapon storage area. But who knows? I mean, anything's possible, right?
I mean, who says it doesn't? Its propulsion system, you know, the nuclear was interfering with this propulsion system, and it had to shed that excess radiation in order to take off again. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. Yeah,
so
no.
I guess that would be my theory. You know what I mean?
Yep. It's certainly a possibility, right?
Sure is. By the way, Casey's back from Sacramento, that call that popped off.
Oh.
Let's go back to him. Go ahead, Casey. There you are.
Sorry about that, guys. Not the greatest phone in the world.
Nothing.
But what I was about to add to the F-111 story about them having the best radar out there is we had an airplane at Mildenhall that was called the RC-135. And it was the greatest electronic snooping 707 ever built. And it had reel-to-reels on it that recorded everything electronic in the area, and they used to fly it up and down the border of Russia. So that would be another lead that you might want to check into on, like, maybe a Freedom of Information Act, because this stuff was on a reel-to-reel, and they you know, replaced the reels every mission. These aircraft flew almost 24/7 around that section of England and going back and forth towards Russia, especially the F-111s that were constantly up 24/7. Now, getting back to the actions of the craft itself, it sounds like a typical unmanned probe that, you know, that basically just did its job, set down if it needed to, you know, scanned what it needed to with its electronic beams, and then took off on a pre-programmed mission.
Right. Might have taken samples. Who knows?
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
I mean, kind of thing that we do, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what we do. And you figure if you have a civilization that's, you know, another 500, you know, years advanced of us, we're going to come up with better unmanned probes just like we are right now, the ones that are sitting on Mars right now. If they had a capability of taking off, which, you know, a lot of them don't because we don't have the technology, doesn't mean to say that somebody else doesn't have the tech.
That's right. Casey, the spy missions over the Soviet Union, were there civilians involved in those planes, do you know?
Well, in the RC-135, they had crews of, you know, 15 or 20 people that monitored different sections of electronics. They had different cryptographic machines in them that allowed the analysts on them to, you know, take in data, take in any kind of electronic data. And there was also a section of people that did nothing but languages, that took in the different languages. And they were linguists on board that, you know, listened to the different radio traffic going in and out of Russia and in and out of the Baltic countries.
I think my uncle, who is dead now, and he never told us what he did, I think he flew planes like that. He would be gone out of Boston for weeks at a time. And, you know, my cousin, Wayne, he didn't know what he did. But he was an expert in electronics. You never know, James, but I think that's what he did.
You know, there's got to be a repository somewhere of a lot of data, film footage, photographs, that sort of thing. Because a lot of the witnesses I talked to that have been on missions similar to what you're talking about, Casey, where they did come back with, you know, photographs or film footage, some kind of tangible evidence, it was quickly couriered off to Washington. And I've heard that so many times. So there's got to be a repository of the most amazing evidence.
Well, you know, here's something that's interesting too, James. You know, all of the events that have been happening on this planet, cattle mutilations, landings, things like that, seem to be out of sequence, because some people have said, now, wait a minute, if ETs have been visiting us since the beginning of time, or they seeded us, they're so advanced, why do they need to test cattle? Why do they need to send unmanned craft here and do samples? Well, my logical explanation for that is this. Who's to say that there aren't a number of different races and civilizations with different agendas who may not be as advanced as the group that came here and seeded us, but they may be at a point where they're more advanced than us, but they're merely starting to do what we're doing, and that's sending probes out. So I think the different things that are going on this planet are being done by different races or beings who aren't as advanced as some of the others.
You know, I asked this question to Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell one time. Why won't they just land on the White House lawn? He said, what would you do if you were exploring space and you came upon life? Would you stand back and observe from a distance, or would you just land in the heart of everything? And I thought, you know, that's a pretty good point. I would probably want to stand back and check out what's going on.
Especially, James, if you witnessed murders, shootings, wars, bombings. Would you come down here in the middle of that?
I'd be like, those guys aren't going to last long.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to say something happened to that planet a long time ago.
They got something wrong in the gene pool.
yeah. This is the prison planet.
I know. It's the sad truth, George.
It truly is. I don't know. Houston, Texas. Tim, only have a minute left for you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I worked in one of the secret programs, one of the magic programs. And I went to one of the military academies where I was commissioned. And when I've had hands-on experience with the equipment that we got from them. And one of the things that I can't understand why we don't do is to use the assets that we have with regards to the various Air Force manuals that have secret parts to them that tell you how to deal with these EBEs, extraterrestrial biological entities. I mean, Air Force Manual 1-1 has two parts. One is public, one is secret. The secret side tells how to deal with them. I mean, it's that straightforward. The government's publishing the information for you.
Can you contact me through my website? I know what I saw. If you Google, I know what I saw. I'd love to talk to you further about this.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
that would be
absolutely
great.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to put him on hold. I'm going to put him on hold for you. And get his number. Tommy, get his number for James.
Thank you so much.
I mean, that could be an incredible story all by itself.
If anybody else out there is interested in knowing more, there's been some amazing articles written up recently in a magazine called Open Minds. And
yeah,
it's been very, very good reporting. Very, very amazing stuff. So they can probably Google that, too.
All right, James Fox, thank you so much. Two just thrilling hours. Back in a moment with Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM.